Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, it's the continuation of our broadcast of the 2020 Spokesman Review Summer Stories. If you missed a past episode from the last 2 weeks, you can listen back anytime by subscribing to The Bookshelf podcast or listen at our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. Tonight's first story on this year's theme, which is Mount St. Helens, is by Spokane author Sharma Shields. She's the author of the Washington State Book Award-winning The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac, the story collection Favorite Monsters, and the Pacific Northwest Book Club Award-winning novel The Cassandra. Here's Spokane Public Radio's Alexis Smith reading Sharma Shields' story, Bandits.
Bandits by Sharma Shields. When Mom fell in love with the Man of Ash, we tried at first to be happy for her. We vacuumed, we mopped, we sang. We swept up the ashes without complaint. Even then, the thin film of him settled beneath our fingernails or whirled up at us from a plumped cushion, catching in our eyelashes. We muttered to one another as we combed him out of our hair. We couldn't be rid of him, even when we were alone. We'd loved the Man of Light. He'd shuffled through our house gently with his long, glowing hair. If we wanted our space, and we always wanted our space, we could easily hide from him in the shadows. He didn't get all over us the way the Man of Ash did. But Mom felt very little for him, and then she felt nothing at all. He lived now in the downstairs broom closet, and it comforted us to know he was there, glowing alone in the darkness, even if we never ventured there to check on him. The Man of Ash was different. He paid us too much attention. I saw the way he watched Fern when her back was turned, his gray hooded eyes dark with hunger, his lips moving subtly within his shaggy charcoal beard. One day she passed too closely by him, and his dense, smoky arms unfurled and clasped her around the waist. He pulled her smoothly into his lap. For a moment, I couldn't see her. She was lost in the cloud of him. Nearby, Mom coughed. I lifted from my chair and hurried to my sister, groping for her hand. "Let's go outside," I said, my fingers encircling her wrist, breathing in the fumy, deep smell of him. He met my eyes, scowling, but to my relief, he released her. Fern rose mechanically from his gloom, her dress filthy now and cindered, and Mom issued a nervous laugh. "Like scared horses, my girls," she'd apologized. "They're not used to men." But we were used to men, all sorts of them. The Man of Light, the Man of Thunder, the Man of Air, who flirted with Mom but stayed just out of her grasp. What we weren't used to was a man who wanted every part of us, who would smother and dirty and settle into us ruinously. "If he touches you again," I told Fern once we were alone, "I'll murder him." My tone frightened her. "Nothing's happened, Minnie," she argued. "I just got too close." "It's not your fault, numbskull," I spat, and regretted my tone when she flinched. We grew careful then, edging along the walls, crawling near the baseboards. We threw buckets of water on the floor to try to sop up the ash that now carpeted our whole home, but it was futile. We retreated whenever we could to our bedroom or to the fresher air of the backyard and garden. One day, after we weeded the garden beds, as I lay on my sore back on the lawn, I told Fern we should run away. My sister was always swift to argue with me, to call out my poor decisions. It wasn't the first time I'd suggested such an enterprise. She plopped down next to me on the grass, and I awaited a quarrel. Instead, she laced her fingers through my own. "This crystalline air," she said, "good for the lungs." She brought my hand to her mouth and kissed my knuckles in a goofy way, and I laughed. I was so grateful for this backyard, the garden we'd tended, the fresh air. The house was covered in his film now, the state of it worsening by the moment. "We'll be bandits," I said. "We'll leave them behind." Fern's smile flashed, then faded. "Why does she always choose them over us? What's wrong with us?" "She'll never change. I know that now." Then I added irritably, "Nothing's wrong with us, Fern." Fern absently poked at a hole in her sneaker. "We'd be happy, just the three of us. Maybe one day she'll see it." For years, we'd done all we could to shake Mom out of her misery. We cooked, we cleaned, we gardened, we drew her bath, we ironed her clothes, we made the beds. But the drinking, the men, the poor choices continued. "A bandit's life for me," I sang, shaking Fern's hand gently. She sprawled out near me and put her head on my shoulder. "I hate everything," she said, as she sometimes did. "But I love you," I rejoined, "most of the time anyway." From the open window in the house came a protuberant cloud of ash, billowing, settling, edging cunningly toward us. Fern eyed it warily, and I eyed her. "Minnie," she whispered, desperate now. "Tell me what it will be like, our bandit life." We crept away from the house on hands and knees toward the small orchard with its squat apple trees. "We'll walk the railway, all the way to the big lake," I said. We tucked ourselves behind the tree trunks, the tendrils of ash curling and uncurling, searching for us. "We'll cross the narrow bridge over the water and skirt the town. There'll be an abandoned cabin in the trees not far from the river, and we'll break in through an unlocked window. It'll be stuffy and dusty there, but no ash. We'll throw open the windows and doors, and we'll clean the entire place, top to bottom, until it glitters and gleams. It'll be ours, and ours alone." "And Martha the Bear?" "Of course, Martha the Bear is there too." "And Peter the Fox?" We were too old now for stuffed animals. We were menstruating girls who in normal situations would soon start public high school. But I wouldn't argue with her. "Yes, Peter too. From time to time, we'll steal into people's homes for food and supplies. We'll boil tea from dandelions and foxgloves. We'll braid columbine in our hair. In the summer, we'll bathe in the lakes, and in the winter, we'll tend the fire in the wood stove." "And Mom?" "Eventually, she'll come to live with us," I lied. "How will she know where to find us?" I shrugged. Just the idea of her coming for us at all had exhausted me. I wasn't sure she ever would, or ever had. The house was quiet. Soon, we knew, she would call to us to come inside, to hug her. She would force us to hug him, too. "We leave," I said, "or we choke." Fern rested her chin on one knee, her gaze on the house. Her face was slightly broader than my own, friendlier, but one of her eyes was darker brown than the other, so that she always seemed half in shadow. This was how people could tell us apart if they bothered. "Minnie," she said, "look." I twisted around to see. The yard was filling up with ash, smothering our garden. We could see the tiny trails of dying insects as they wiggled and flailed against the invasion. From the murky rooms, we heard Mom's cough, hacking now, violent. She'd absorbed too much of him. We pulled our t-shirts up over our noses, stepped across the powdery detritus, hurried to our room. "Tonight," I told her, reaching into our closet to retrieve our bags. "Or else." To my relief, Fern agreed. Days passed, then months. In our dusky cabin near the big lake, we whiled away the hours. Men of stone, men of trees, men of water, men of ice, men of light and ash. None of them bothered us. Now it was just stone, trees, water, ice, light, and the sparkling dust made from our own living bodies. We no longer cleaned up daily, but on Mondays, and that suited us fine. We took jobs at the local grocery, one of us with a shift in the morning and the other with a shift at night. In the summer, we put on our jewel-colored jelly sandals and walked into town. We bought popsicles and perused books at the library. We knew disasters were unfolding both near and far, but we paid them no attention. We were free from anyone's terror but our own. I didn't tell Fern when Mom arrived. Fern was searching for fiddleheads in the woods. She wanted to make an omelet for supper. She was curious about a set of boys who we worked with at the grocery. "They're not men of any one substance," she assured me, and she talked of inviting them over. I didn't encourage or discourage her. After having a mother who didn't care enough, I didn't want to be a mother at all, only a sister, a friend. It was Mom's cough I heard first. The rattle of it rent the air. Its vibrations skimmed across the lake. I'd been staring out at the calm water over a sinkload of dishes, daydreaming of summer and swimming. We wondered if and when the family would return to their summer cottage, which we'd broken into swiftly and easily not long after crossing the narrow bridge, and we feared the moment of arrival the way we had once feared God. In a bedroom bureau, I'd found a red swimsuit and it fit perfectly. I'd stood in front of the bureau's large mirror and Fern, holding Martha the Bear on her lap, exclaimed that if it wasn't for the port wine stain across my chest, I'd look like a supermodel. We'd laughed for an entire night about that, imagining a more glamorous life for me as a catwalk ingenue. A life of caviar and expensive clothing and rich friends and loneliness. The opposite of what we shared now. And now that familiar cough. I stepped outside, still wiping my hands on a dish rag. And there she was, our mom, a long, pale specter emerging from the tall grass. I crossed the gravel carport to speak with her, but Fern was already there, putting her arms around Mother, sobbing. Oh no, I thought. Fern would invite her in. Fern would make a new home for her. And it would all begin again, all the neglect and harm. Mother coughed, and the ash sailed out from her lungs. The man of ash was inside of her. She'd never be free of him, and she'd brought him to us like a disease. I heard what she mumbled to Fern, that she was sorry, that she was a terrible mother, that she needed our help. Coughs erupted one after another, expunging dense scuds of volcanic rock and glass. And my sister, assailed by them, transformed into an old woman before my eyes, flesh and hair graying and singed. To my chagrin, she embraced our mother even harder, telling her she was understood, she was seen. And I sank into a paralysis of misery. Fern would be destroyed by her own capacity for love. I'd always known it. I couldn't approach and free her, my feet held fast to the gravel as if I were a tree newly planted. I prepared myself for the end of us. But then Fern, squeezing Mom even tighter, tears staining her ashen cheeks, said, "I love you, but I can't let you near us now, Mom, for Minnie's sake, for my own." The embrace intensified. Mom's cough worsened. Her eyes bulged, her bones cracked, muscles and viscera liquefied. Fern held her in such a tight embrace, her whole body rippling from the effort, that I worried the earth would open up beneath our feet, the sinkhole swallowing us all. I called out Fern's name, to let go to save herself, but my voice only strengthened her resolve. She bore down and the embrace became a vise, then a spike, then a fire. The heat of it assailed us. All at once, I regained motion of my feet and stumbled forward, blindly grasping for my sister's shoulders. The ash settled around us. The clouds, having gathered darkly overhead, released a cleansing rain. In Fern's hands, she held what was left of our mother, a small ceramic ring, which she offered to me, gasping. "You wear it," I said. I was so grateful, so moved. We stood in the afternoon light, just the two of us, facing the water. Taking up her hand, my flesh grazed the thread-like circle near her knuckle, the small, firm proof of Mom's remaining love. The rain sluiced over us, returning my sister's youth to her, the gray melting from her hair in grotesque clumps. I was shocked at how strong she'd become, how resolute. I gave her hand a squeeze, and then let go. Before us, the lake was just lake. The stone was just stone. The light was just light. The boys my sister wanted to befriend were just boys. This was what I hoped, anyway. We allowed the day to yawn before us, as filled with potential for good and ill as any of us living beings. I breathed deeply the petrichor. I hid my naked hands in my sleeves.
That was Alexis Smith reading Sharma Shields' short story, Bandits, from this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories fiction series. This year's theme was Mount St. Helens. Our next story is by Samuel Ligon. He's the author of the novels Among the Dead and Dreaming and Safe in Heaven Dead, and the story collections Wonderland and Drift and Swerve. A co-creator and co-editor of Pie and Whiskey, Writers Under the Influence of Butter and Booze, Ligon teaches in the Creative Writing Graduate Program at Eastern Washington University and is artistic director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference. Here's Samuel Ligon reading his short story, St. Helen and the Spokenites.
St. Helen and the Spokenites. Pawpaw said it was just hippies on the mountain got smote, and fornicators. Nary a Christian among them, he said. What about my Grandpa Murphy's camp, I said. Closed, Pawpaw said, and they was Catholic anyway, not Christian. Catholic is Christian, my mother said, and it's not just hippies up there. So blame your lesbian governor, Pawpaw said, if that makes you feel better. Dad, my mother said. Lesbian, I said. Everywhere, Meemaw said, with their pantsuits and raucous talk. Not like the good old days, Mom said, when we were all miners and loggers and prostitutes. Prostitutes, Garrett said, and Papa said, you don't know a thing about the good old days. Nor loggers, Meemaw said, nor miners, but it used to be Indians, our mother said. And cowboys, Garrett said. You don't know a thing about Indians, Papa said, nor migrant workers, nor any of the others you take up for. Nor sodomites, Meemaw said, nor Israelites. They're just people up there, our mother said, like anywhere else. The light dimmed in the living room, the first sign of the cloud coming. And now his wrath is upon us, Papa said. Garrett cried as the sky went darker. Our mother picked him up, even though he was too big to be picked up. It's not God's wrath, she said. It's ash from the volcano. Literal brimstone, Papa said. Come here, Seth, my mother said, pulling me in with my brother. It's going to be all right. You don't have to cry about it, Meemaw said. He can cry if he wants to, my mother said. I'm not crying, I said. Papa had the radio blasting. You're lucky you got out when you did, he said. Lucky you listened for once. We'd been in Spokane since the mountain woke up, but Mom said it wasn't about that. It was about money. It was always in him, Papa said. Don't, my mother said. To slink and slunk, leave it, Meemaw said. Lightning sparkled through the falling ash, prickling our necks and arms. My mother wrapped us tighter. The top of the mountain appears to be gone, the radio said. Gone? Garrett said, and Papa said, good riddance to bad rubbish. Where did it go? Garrett said. On top of us, Papa said. Was Dad there? I said, and my mother said, of course not. Could have been, Papa said. Leave it, Mima said. Likely as anywhere, Papa said. But I didn't believe him. The camp wasn't on top of the mountain anyway. Get in the car, boys, our mother said. We're leaving. I headed for the stairs and my stuff, but didn't know if my old school would take me back. I don't want to go out there, Garrett said. I turned and looked at my mother. Her eyes were closed tight. You're not going anywhere, Papa said. Our dad had been gone a long time, but we stayed in Longview and waited. He used to take us to the abandoned camp on the mountain Grandpa Murphy had built with its falling down cabins and pool full of dirt. We camped there before kindergarten, the next year too. Mom said I couldn't remember all the times we camped there, but I did. Garrett pouring water into the lake, how it sparkled as it tumbled from his jug. Mom and Dad on the shore at night, kissing. Sometimes you can't see the blessing for the sin, Papa said. I was under the card table where the train was laid out, our suitcases piled by the door. It was still snowing ash, but we weren't allowed out in it. Garrett was watching TV. Papa had made the train and the tracks and the little people who could ride it, pioneers and Indians and outlaws, plus a tunnel from an old cracker can. Of course you did the right thing, Mima said in the kitchen. The only thing you could do. And this is where you are now. Just don't say he was there then, my mother said. I heard the clicking of Mima's lighter. Nobody said that, Papa said. And my mom said, you said it. It could have been anywhere, Papa said, is what I was saying. Are you so mean, my mother said, to not understand what you're saying? Don't think for a minute, Papa said. I won't throw you out of here again. Leonard, Mima said. I was ready to go. Constance, Mima said. Garrett didn't notice anything outside the TV. Come on now, Mima said. Let it go for a minute. For the boys, she said. For you, too. Is that what you'd do, Mom? Can't you see it might be a good thing, Mima said, to let him go? And my mom said, no, I can't. I'm not saying he was a bad man, Papa said. Of course you are, Mom said. You say it, and you think it, and you always have. I looked at the people on the train waiting to be annihilated by the Indians and outlaws. Garrett jumped off the couch and zoomed around the room, singing with the kids on TV. Our dad might have been at the camp, or he might have been anywhere in the world. The only places I ever thought of him were on the mountain or at our house in Longview, on the porch or feeding the wood stove or cooking with my mom at night. Never here with Papa and Mima. The hard part's not knowing, our mother always said. He could be in jail down in Mexico, she said, or drowned in the Sound and washed out to sea. He could show up any moment, she used to say, but he never did. Our dad said there was a spirit in the mountain and all around that place. You can feel it, he said. That's my father, he said, and there's Uncle George. Mom and Garrett were still asleep. It was cold up there so early in the morning. Like a ghost, I said. Kind of, Dad said. Like God, I said. Mima and Papa talked about God, but Dad never did. You can call it that if you want, he said. Do you call it that? He pulled the coffee pot from the fire and started mixing pancake batter. Get me those huckleberries, he said. I opened the cooler, the bag leaking purple juice all the way back to the fire. Is that what you call it, I said. I don't call it anything, he said. It's more of a feeling. He dropped the berries into the batter. How about some bacon, he said. I went to the cooler and pulled out the bacon. Like a saint, maybe, I said. I don't know much about saints, my dad said, to tell you the truth. It got loud again in the kitchen, then got quiet and stayed quiet. Our mom came into the living room. We're going now, she said. Outside, the sky was full of ash. We had to bundle ourselves in winter coats and snow pants and goggles for protection. Toxic ash, the radio called it. You'll never get anywhere, Papa said. The interstate's closed. Constance, please, Mima said. The boys. I don't want to go, Garrett said. Don't be a baby, I said. You're the baby, Garrett said. Let's go, our mother said. And we walked outside, the ash over everything, the sidewalk, the lawn, our Chevy Malibu parked in the driveway. "Where are we going?" Garrett asked when we were inside the car. "Home," our mother said. He pulled off his hat and goggles and wriggled out of his snow pants. We were covered in ash. "I thought this was home now," he said. "Hush, Garrett," I said. "You hush," he said. "You're not the boss of me." Mom turned on the radio and turned it off. Garrett didn't remember our dad. You couldn't tell what time it was, just dark, all that ash sweeping and swirling. I had friends in Longview, but Mom said someone else was in our house now, another family. I hardly remembered our dad either. It had been over a year, maybe two. I didn't know how long it had been. "We'll stay with your cousins," Mom said, "till we're back on our feet." The car started bucking and coughing. "No," our mother said. We made it another block before the Malibu stopped completely. "God damn it," our mother said. She tried to start it again. "God damn it," she said, pounding the steering wheel with her open hands. A man knocked on her window. "Ain't gonna run now," he said. "Filter's clogged." We sat for a minute while ash covered the windshield. "It's okay, Mom," I said. But she didn't try to hide her crying, which made Garrett cry in the seat behind us. We bundled back up, Garrett sniffling. The streetlights were on and more people were outside. Everything felt upside down. Night in the afternoon, a snow day in summer. All of us bundled and covered in that soft, light ash. You couldn't help sticking out your tongue to try to catch some. It tasted like pennies or like water from the lake, just a little on your lips when you came up for air. There were markings in the ash for days, like on the moon or in the mud by the lake. If you followed those lines, you'd find a dead bug, a bee or a grasshopper covered in ash. Sometimes there were animal tracks, dog, cat, wolf, badger. I gathered ash, filling jars with it. Everyone did. Moose tracks appeared, bear and cougar and Sasquatch and other animals big enough to survive. I imagined them pulling themselves from the ash on the mountain and making their way to Meemaw and Pawpaw's patio out back, hundreds of miles from home. The rest of the mountain would come to Spokane too, Meemaw said, but only if I believed it would. Only if I prayed hard enough to make it true.
That was Samuel Ligon reading his short story, St. Helen and the Spokanites, from this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories. You can read all of this year's stories at spokesman.com and listen back to this and other episodes by subscribing to the Bookshelf Podcast or finding us at SpokanePublicRadio.org. We'll be back tomorrow with our final two stories by Dan Gemeinhardt and Jess Walter. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini.